From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review, for the week ending June 30th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, the Indiana Supreme Court ruled that the state's near-total abortion ban does not violate Indiana's Constitution. The ban is now set to go into effect within the next month or so. Under the law, abortions are only allowed if the pregnant person's serious health or life is at risk, if there's a lethal fetal anomaly up to 20 weeks post-fertilization, and in cases of rape or incest, but only up to 10 weeks. How will this ruling impact Hoosiers? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, before I get to the question, a little further explanation. There is a separate lawsuit challenging the abortion ban under the state's Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That is ongoing. The law was halted in that case, but only as it applies to the people who brought that lawsuit, who said their religious beliefs were infringed.
And maybe
it's possible that that ruling has been expanded to cover anyone in the states whose religious beliefs specifically say they need to get an abortion. But even that's a relatively small group of people. Mm-hmm. So, under today's ruling, for the vast majority of Hoosiers, abortion is now largely illegal.
Right.
And barring a significant change in the General Assembly, is it likely to stay that way for the foreseeable future?
Oh, I think it probably is. I'm obviously disappointed. I thought the Supreme Court would recognize that women have a right under our Constitution to control our own bodies. They didn't do that. What they did say is that women have a right to life. I mean, they have a right to live. Okay, well, there are some in the Republican Party that would deny women that right, which would say you'd carry the child to term even if it means the woman's life or health. So I suppose that's something approaching progress, but it doesn't reflect where Hoosiers are. And I thought one of the most interesting things was one of the justices suggesting that this ought to be on the ballot as a constitutional amendment. But the Republicans won't do that because they know they're not in touch with what Hoosiers want. They're going to come back being emboldened in part with this because the Supreme Court doesn't recognize the constitutional exception for rape and incest, and it doesn't recognize it for a certain period of time either. So the crazies, and there are a number in the caucus on the Republican side, will come back in with proposals to ban it in rape and incest and in other situations like that. And that is not where Hoosiers are. Okay, and that is outrageous, but that's what they're going to try to do.
To that point, the ruling only says life or serious health risk to the pregnant person. It leaves out rape or incest in terms of a constitutionally protected right. We saw those votes, though, in the special session. There was a straight up or down vote in both chambers on should the rape and incest exception be taken out of the law, and there was about 30% in each chamber who said yes. Those shouldn't be exceptions. Are those numbers unlikely to change much if they took that vote again at the State House?
Yeah, I think so, because, well, two things happened. One, there was no political consequence either for the ban that was put in place, that was voted in place and now determined that it will go in place. And there was no political consequence on the far right for taking out those exceptions, except that's not as clean a political theory that I can promote. Because we were in the middle of an election year. We were 90 days out from an election. It wasn't a totally clean look at what are actually the politics of this. Now, you could argue that it was also top of mind for voters. This had just happened. This U.S. Supreme Court had just thrown out Roe. The Indiana General Assembly had just come in and put this ban and the restrictions in place. And then we had an election. So it was never going to be more in front of Indiana voters than it was then. So what has to happen now? If you're Democrats, you've got to build a campaign. If you really believe that this is out of step with Hoosiers, you've got to build a campaign into that. And we have no evidence that the Hoosier electorate is going to punish Republicans for that ban or reward Democrats for being opposed to it.
So do you think we? So do you think
you
we
keep saying that? Yeah, but there's no evidence.
Yeah. Do you think
election after election?
Do you think we should expect then, in the 2024 legislative session, not just legislation filed, but legislation to move that would take away the exceptions for cases of rape and incest.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be a part of the election. Democrats are already making it a part of the election.
But I mean, before we get to the election, in the next session of the General Assembly.
Oh, will there be amendments brought, yeah, and votes cast? And there'll certainly be an attempt for that. There will certainly be an attempt to put these political votes on the floor of the House, especially.
I want to talk about what Mike's just said in terms of a lack of electoral consequences, really, after last year and the abortion ban was passed. At the same, I agree that it was never more front of mind in terms of the Hoosier voters, but it wasn't in effect.
Right. Yeah.
It wasn't in effect. Right. The ban, at no point up until 30 days from now, essentially, was ever really in effect for the vast majority of Hoosiers.
Right.
We are now going to have, presumably, more than a year until next year's election where the ban will be in effect and almost no Hoosiers have the right to abortion. Will that have more, and it'll be a presidential election year.
Yes, that will have a greater impact. That's where I would take issue with your assessment, which I think is on target in many ways. It's not a referendum because, to your point, the consequences haven't been clear to the average Hoosier. I think most Hoosiers would say, yeah, they enacted a ban in the General Assembly. I remember reading something about that or hearing something about it, but nothing seems to have changed. Well, that's right, because everything has been on hold, essentially. And as we started at the outset of the show, you indicated 30 days or so, that is likely to change. And that's when you will see the kind of coverage that we've seen in other states that are further down this pike, where you have women who die or suffer serious health consequences because physicians and emergency rooms are, you know, torn. They're not sure. They're ambivalent, and they're unsure about the statute and its implications for them and their ability to practice or their ability to stay out of jail. So I think when those types of real-world scenarios start to unfold, it would have a bigger consequence. And one other point I would make just about the General Assembly, will they still be emboldened to bring? Absolutely. Look at Kansas. Kansas was one of the first made headlines not long after the Dodds decision by enshrining in the state constitution at the ballot box the right of a woman to have an abortion. And that hasn't kept the Kansas General Assembly from enacting law after law after law. Now, they'll probably be struck down at the state Supreme Court level, but they're still being enacted in the face of that.
I want to ask about, John just pointed out, the real-world consequences of this, and we see it most directly in other states, as he pointed out, doctors unsure what to do. Is that particularly pointed here, where if there is even the slightest hint of ambivalence about what the law would and would not allow that doctor to do in that specific situation, it's abundantly clear that this attorney general is going to attack every doctor who he thinks maybe might have come close to stepping over the line. But I mean, to that point, is that going to make doctors even more afraid than they are in other states?
Absolutely. Now what we're going to see is, you know, massive discussions and cases and real life examples of what is a serious health risk. Does that count mental challenges? Does, you know, also even the idea of if the life of the mother is at risk is a medical interpretation. And one doctor can agree one way and one doctor can agree another way. And those are the things that are going to now be litigated every minute. And Justice Mulder, and, you know, said in the case, he said, yeah, bring not necessarily bring on the challenges, but yeah, we're going to have to decide these cases on an applied basis with specific facts and situations of Hoosiers.
The one good thing about this and the whole discussion since the Supreme Court case a year ago is that I think men have a much greater appreciation of just how risky pregnancy is. I mean, people just think, well, you go, you have a baby, no big deal. There are so many complications that come from this that fall into that category, whether it's an atopic pregnancy, whatever it is, that could risk the mother's life. And ones that are close, but maybe not. And I can just see the doctor standing there, well, I really think we should take the fetus, but let's go get a legal opinion before I do that. It is crazy.
As the lawyer on the panel, I want to ask about, you know, what Nikki just talked about. So Justice Mulder, who wrote the opinion, the newest justice, which I think some of us found a little surprising that he was the one who authored it. But he acknowledged that there is a lot of litigation left that this ruling today does not answer. And he, as you said, he kind of invited, like, okay, then we will take those cases as they come to us. But they're mostly as applied, which means there actually has to be, you know, a person going through this in order for it to apply. How do you litigate something like that when you have 20 weeks at best,
or, you don't. You make a decision one way or the other, and the woman dies or the woman lives.
But how are you going to litigate that?
Then you get Todd Rokita charging in on his white horse and saying you shouldn't have done that, second-guessing the medical opinion. And that is where we're really dangerous, because doctors are threatened with this. They're threatened. They want to do what's right by the patient, and what the Indiana, the Supreme Court and the General Assembly is saying, we're going to second guess whatever you do.
I mean, you litigated endlessly, we litigated Roe endlessly, endlessly, and against the legal right, and now against the bans, right? Yeah. It'll be nation.
But you didn't have a Todd Rokita in Roe.
Well, you're going to have
lots of Todd Rokitas all over the country.
You're going to have some judges on call. I'm being somewhat facetious there, but I'm reminded of the case that former Chief Appellate Court Judge John Baker, back when he was Monroe County Court Judge, and was presented with the Baby Doe case, which was should the family be able to – it was a grievously compromised child who was not going to live. And so the question was some sort of Herculean efforts to maintain what was – to thwart an inevitable outcome. And he basically said – I think he had 20 minutes. He went in his study in his chambers with law books and came out with a pronouncement. And that sort of – for better or for worse, dogged, shaped his career. It didn't hurt his career, certainly. Yeah. He rose to great things.
Under a Democrat.
Well, not politics.
But
that's the kind of thing that we're going to be seeing, you know, in any county, any hospital that performs these. I can say, you're by your phone.
It is ridiculous. And we should have control of our own bodies, period.
Speaking of Supreme Court decisions, but not the Indiana one, Indiana universities reacted to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision this week to end affirmative action in college admissions. Protection clause.
And so there's no room to argue that diversity.
Supporters of the practice argue it's essential for creating a diverse student body. Jennifer Mason McAward is an associate professor of law at Notre Dame. She says the court took an absolutist approach to the Equal Protection Clause.
And so there's no room to argue that diversity is so important that we have to do this. There's no room to argue that really these programs might help certain applicants. The court just comes up with a very clear line saying you just can't do this.
Several universities issued statements indicating they intend to follow the law. Indiana University added that it was committed to fostering a learning environment with, quote, a broad range of backgrounds. Mike O'Brien, Governor Holcomb was asked about this by me, actually, on the day the ruling came out. He said he hadn't read it, but he said, I don't want to be aloof, but I'm not concerned about the impact to Indiana's institutions. Is he right to be unconcerned?
Well, I mean, he has a right to be concerned if schools in Indiana were making decisions on admissions solely on race, which I don't know if they were or not. I presume they weren't, and it's a lot of factors that go into admission. I actually appreciate it there's a lot of hyperbole on both sides, right, on the extremes on racism versus anti-discrimination. But I thought Mike Pence had a good reaction. As the only Republican presidential candidate, I think, that acknowledged that there was a time for affirmative action. He just disagrees that it's still the time for affirmative action. He was really the only candidate I saw that even acknowledged there was a credible argument for affirmative action at some point in the last, in the last several decades. And Joe Biden, of course, President Biden came out and blasted the opinion, of course, but then appealed to universities taking, difficulty in life, difficulty in life generally. Are you economically disadvantaged? Are you disadvantaged from the part of the country you're in? And that's really, we've talked about it before, and I was thinking about this. We always think about urban black students when we think about upward mobility and admission to college, and that is true for a lot of reasons. Lack of economic opportunity, failing school districts, bad health outcomes, everything that goes into your ability to, move upward on the economic scale. That's true in rural America now too, or as it wasn't years, as a generation ago. I've said on the show several times that as we've come up with these issues of mental health and health outcomes and maternal health and all these things, that rural Indiana and urban Indiana aren't remarkably different in terms of your opportunities to get out of those places. So adversity was the term that President Biden used. If you can take into consideration adversity, I think that's a noble way to look at that. And I'm not offended by that at all, because it does require, I think what Mike Pence was alluding to was, this was appropriate at the time. It has become a fairly blunt reason to admit somebody into school and not, without taking into consideration modern challenges that keep you from going to where you're at in life to where you're trying to go.
And I was struck by the ruling. I think I'm getting this right, in that the court, John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, didn't say you can't ever consider race at all in any way. He was saying simply that these policies are unconstitutional. But race, as so many of them, Mike just said, as so many other parts of who a person is, can be considered. And so is it really going, in terms of how catastrophic or not this ruling's impact will be, is it really going to be up to the institutions now to say, are we committed to giving people a leg up and weighing that in our admissions decisions, whoever the person is, or not?
Well, I think it's going to be, and I think there were some comments from institutions saying that's exactly what they were going to do, which is important because we've always recognized that higher education's the stepping stone to middle class. And when you see what's happened, like in California, where they had a constitutional amendment to ban affirmative action, the number of minority students graduating from California institutions dropped by 40%. So that is concerning. So if they can find a way...
Michigan closer to home, Santa, similar, not 40%, but a similar drop.
Well, I mean, there you go. So if they can look at the disadvantages in the background, which include race, because, you know, the Supreme Court decision is talking about an America that we're not in yet, okay? There are residual effects from slavery and racism. There are. And, you know, you can bury your head in the sand and think this is utopia. It is not. And we need to address those concerns. If we do it through this method of looking at what the disadvantaged backgrounds are, and it doesn't result in smaller numbers of minorities getting access to that middle class, okay. But I think it's concerning that every institution follows those kinds of guidelines.
The tricky part with this is, you know, we just talked about whether it's the impact of the Indiana Supreme Court's ruling on abortion. We're probably going to start seeing that once the ban fully takes effect relatively quickly. With this one, it could be a decade before we really start to see hard, like, numbers that show an impact of this, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if at least 4 years, right? Till you start getting, you know, graduation numbers and college degrees. But I do think there are routes out there for colleges to still have a commitment. I think income level, poverty level is a big one that they could probably focus more on in terms of, and that will get at the same group of people.
Right, because black and brown communities are disproportionately
absolutely
lower income than white communities.
Definitely. Yeah,
right.
So I think there are some options, and I think it'll be interesting to see some of these universities recraft their policies in a way that still tries to diversify the student population.
Yeah, because I'm struck by this in terms of now it feels a lot more like it falls on individual institutions to step up if they're going to really be committed to providing folks that step up the economic ladder or not. But it also strikes me that a lot of the impact of this isn't going to be nearly as broad as I think some are portraying it to be, because the number of higher education institutions in Indiana and across this country who are really selective in their admissions policies is relatively small when you consider all the people who go to college in this country. Most colleges let most people in, and this isn't really going to impact those
schools.
Look
at Indiana. The numbers I saw, there are 9 institutions or 9 campuses that were using this as part of a, you know, the metric of admission, and that would be the main campuses of IU and Purdue, not necessarily the ancillary campuses, which is interesting. Notre Dame, which I find interesting because they had filed a friend of the court brief supporting the status quo, which was clearly opposite alumna and former professor Amy Coney Barrett. But to that extent, it might not affect much. But keep in mind that quotas and that kind of rigid consideration of race has been off the table since the Bakke decision back in late 70s, the U.S. Supreme Court. So we've already, that's out. So now we were down to sort of using race as one of the many factors. And what I can see, though, is more litigation here, because just as we talked about abortion being a, you know, is it this or that interpretation? Here, when does adversity, you know, how do, that's an awfully hard distinction to draw. When racism is why I didn't have the opportunity as others, and I've overcome that adversity, I can see people, I can see majority students at very select institutions filing suits saying that so-and-so got a break, even in the face of this decision that cheated me, the majority applicant. So this is not the end of this by any stretch.
And what you're going to do is you're going to have a lot more subjective criteria. There'll be a lot less reliance on standardized tests and standing in the community.
Which opens the door to more litigation.
It does. But the other question I have, too, is that 40% drop in California, how many of those were students who would have applied who didn't apply? Because maybe they thought they weren't welcome, or maybe they thought they didn't have a chance. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, it's kind of hard to quantify.
And that's going to be now reliant on the state and the, you know, Commission for Higher Education and groups like that to not just keep track, but also to go into those communities and say, no, this is still important if this is the path you want for yourself, and you should still apply, and you will have a chance to go to these schools. I mean, we just saw the 21st Century Scholars Program.
Now, everyone
who's eligible is going to be signed up. That sort of thing will help.
It will help.
Remember, this decision also does exempt the service academies, so draw a conclusion you want.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, was the U.S. Supreme Court right to end affirmative action? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should Indiana legalize cannabis in some form? 21% of you say yes, but only for medicinal use. 72% say yes, full adult recreational use. And just 7% don't think it should be legalized in any form. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana lawmakers are calling for solutions following a WFYI investigation that revealed some schools aren't accurately reporting how often they forcibly isolate and restrain students. And the data that does exist is inaccessible to most Hoosiers. WFYI's Lee Gaines reports lawmakers want more oversight and protection for students.
Indiana schools are required to report how often they restrain and seclude kids to the Indiana Department of Education. But some schools aren't accurately reporting this information, and the data that is reported is nearly impossible for parents to find. Representative Ed Delaney says the state needs to make this information easily accessible.
That's a no-brainer. First of all, I want all this data available. I want parents of kids who are disabled to be able to get this, get it easily.
Delaney, an Indianapolis Democrat, says he plans to work with the Indiana Department of Education to figure out how to hold schools accountable for failing to report this information to the state.
John Schwanes, does this require a legislative solution, or is it really just better enforcement of existing laws?
Yes, the glib answer. You want to think that enforcement is, presumably we have the statutes and the disclosure requirements in place, and supposedly it seems they're being ignored, or it's been so many impediments and hurdles have been put in the way of people who want this information, it's a de facto prohibition on the release of this information. So yes, if there were adherence to the guidelines and statutes in place, then that's the answer. If it's, that still doesn't fix the problem, the reason I say yes, then that does require a solution. Because keep in mind, we've been talking about accountability and transparency and disclosure on all things academic for decades. You know, what your curriculum is, what your textbook is. We had proponents of people saying, if you hear my child want to use a different pronoun, or then report this. But what could be more profound than physically restraining somebody
and forcibly isolating
somebody? To me, that's far more fundamentally concerning, potentially, than everything else I just mentioned.
Mike, the original law that was supposed to provide the transparency here was a bipartisan solution. Lawmakers have been sort of nibbling around the edges of isolation and seclusion, or seclusion and restraint, for a little while now. Does this shine a much brighter focus on the legislature stepping into this area?
It does, and it should. And hope. And the teachers who are actually engaged in this situation need to be considered in that legislative fight too, because they're being restrained because they're causing physical harm to themselves and others. That's why they're being restrained, and you're putting teachers in an incredibly difficult situation to make a discretionary call in that moment with other, and then call for other resources to that room to restrain those students. And it is So they need help in that too.
Because in a lot of cases, these are special education teachers as well. And as we've talked about on the show before, we are struggling, like many states, to find special education teachers.
So, because it's a risky profession.
Right. It is a very challenging profession on top of an already very challenging profession.
Right.
So is it time for more of a legislative look at this again?
Well, I think they need to look at the resources. They need to look at the number of special education teachers. But the transparency has to be there. The parents have to know about this. They have to be aware of it. And you want to encourage that. I mean, you want to have enough resources there that the teacher can do what's best for the child, what's best for the class, and also inform people who need to know.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.